My name is Dawn Funk, and today is March 30th, 2007. This interview is being conducted in conjunction with the History Department at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte as part of the Voices of the New South series under the direction of Dr. Karen Flint. I am using the Eterol No. 2 digital recorder. I am here today with Mr. Arthur Williams. Mr. Williams, thank you for speaking with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Mr. Williams, will you please start by telling us when you were born and where you grew up?
I was born here in Charlotte, North Carolina, the 5th day of August, 1931, which makes me 76, the 5th of August coming up. I'm getting too old. Okay. Now, what else you want me to say?
And where you grew up, I know
I grew up in different parts of Charlotte. I lived in Brooklyn in my early years, and I worked in Brooklyn up until I was about 14 years old. So I was in Brooklyn. I have been in Brooklyn just about all my life. Even though we had homes in different places in Charlotte, in Greenville, and in Brooklyn. I spent most of my early life in Brooklyn, and most of my adulthood was spent right here in Brooklyn. And I think I remember Brooklyn better than I remember any other place that I've lived. It was a great experience, one that I'll never forget. This is where I learned about life in Brooklyn. I did a lot of things growing up. I started out shining shoes during the Second World War. I got to be pretty good at it. Made a lot of money off those soldiers that coming through here and getting a shine. I guess they just felt sorry for me. I had made my own shoe shine box, and I got so good at it that my uncle wanted me to work for him in shine shoes. So I did that. Incidentally, this was in Brooklyn too, his barbershop, which was a 9-chair barbershop, the largest barbershop in the city of Charlotte at that time, black or white. And he had me to shine shoes in his barbershop. I could keep all the money I made, I just had to sweep up the hair, and I also had a shine stand in there to make my little money that way too. Now, when I start talking, I kind of get diarrhea of the lips. So if you feel like laughing, you go ahead and laugh, because I'm going to tell you this just like it is. I knew everything in Charlotte, and mostly everything in Brooklyn, starting from my uncle's barbershop. No, let me go back to where we used to live. We used to live the last block of Brown Street. That's one of the streets of old Brooklyn. Now there's been some more added on to Brooklyn, but I don't know nothing about it, about how it came about. Because when I was little, Brooklyn consisted of the area kind of east of McDowell. McDowell running north and south. I would say the east part of McDowell on down to Sugar Creek. That's what we used to call Brooklyn when I was coming up. Now, everything in Second Ward has claimed to be a part of Brooklyn. Now, Charlotte is split up into four quadrants. First Ward, Second Ward, Third Ward, and Fourth Ward, and I know every ward. Now, there are subdivisions of Second Ward. There's whatever you call them, Second Ward, First Ward, or anywhere throughout the city of Charlotte. Like Fourth Ward, they got Biddleville, part of Fourth Ward, Greenville, Selwyn Park, that nobody knows about now because it's been swept up in redevelopment, wiped away, and I don't know what all is there now. Charlotte ain't what it was when I was coming up. But getting back to Brooklyn, the mecca of Brooklyn, as I see it, was McDowell Street. Now, they changed it around and started calling the area from Brevoort Street on back down to McDowell, they included that as part of Brooklyn too in the later years. But like I said, when I was little, that was not considered as Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Now, everything is a part of Brooklyn that was part of Second Ward. Maybe it was. I don't know. I'm just telling you, like, I saw it when I was coming up, and I knew it. Mm-hmm. So, starting up from Bavoy Street, where I shine shoes at my uncle's barbershop, that MIC building on the corner of 3rd and Bavoy Street, it had all kind of black businesses, business offices in that overall building. They had doctor's office, real estate office, anything that had something to do with the business, or if you were a doctor, that's what that building was about. The drugstore was underneath the MIC building. That was Dr. Yancey. Mm-hmm. Then they had, my uncle was next door, and then Susan's Grill was next door to him, and Bill Brown's Smoke Shop, where you could play your numbers and do anything else that was legal or illegal. But then that was 60, 70 years ago. We had Second Street was the home of the Lincoln Theater. It was also the busiest black business block in the city of Charlotte. They had the YMCA. Let's see, did I say the Lincoln Theater? Hey, Lincoln Theater, Fred Kemp's Place, Isla's Drugstore, several other cafes, to include Ames Ingram, who later opened up El Chico down on McDowell Street. Mm-hmm. But they also had the Green Willow Garden, which was it was kind of a nightlife place. They had bands and had a dance platform. It wasn't a floor. It was just a platform that was set up with a piccolo on the corner. And when they got some name group or band or something in there, then that piccolo was covered up, and the band took the stage. It was called the Old Green Willow Garden. There were so many people down through there. It used to be like Times Square in New York. And also, on Friday evening when Camp Sutton, this was in the 40s when the Second World War was going on, there was no men around. They would let those guys come down here in 2½ trucks. They let them out on 2nd Street because that's far they wanted to go. There'd be women lined up and down the street. And they just, you know, it was just people meeting each other, having a good time. And everybody had some kind of little means of making some money. There were people out there barbecuing pigs and sides of cows or whatever, selling and eating and partying and doing it. And then we go back down to my place where I started out. I mean, this is just some of the things that happened as you know, as I grew up. And I was pretty big then, and I knew things, and I learned a lot of people, old and young. But down where I came up, down on Brown Street, there was an orphan home down the street. We lived next to the last house on the street, and down beneath us was a great big cow pasture. That cow pasture belonged to the orphan home. As long as I've been in Charlotte, that's all of my 76 years. I never knew the name of that orphan home, and I've seen it. It just didn't, you know, register in my brain. I didn't want to remember it no way. I don't remember things like that. I don't care about it, you know. But I do remember the orphan home. And it's got a name out front now. People go there and get married in one of them little buildings that used to set as part of the orphan home property. The church, I guess, or the chapel. Mm-hmm. But anyway, people go over there now. Mm-hmm. and pay big money to get married.
Oh, wow.
Do you know about that?
Is it St. Mary's?
it's probably, if you go down 4th Street, as soon as you cross underneath that overdrive thing, before you get up to King Drive,
okay,
it's right there on the corner. They even got a Vietnam...
The memorial.
You got a Vietnam memorial. Well, that little house there is the church of that orphan home.
Okay.
Yeah, so... but I never cared to know the name of it or cared anything about it one way or the other.
What about the people who lived there, the orphans who lived there? You interacted with them while you were living there, the orphans at the orphan home?
Well, the cow pastor ran down near my house. The orphan home was over in that King Drive corridor.
Mm-hmm.
It's right in there, partially where the old Charlottetown Mall or the Midtown Mall, where they're building something new now.
Right.
That's where it was, right in there. And the creek, it runs underground now. They've got it closed over. Old Sugar Creek.
Oh, okay.
Sugar Creek used to flood over every time it rained because it wasn't a wide creek. And that thing, when it ran over, it went all the way up, all the way over to Pearl Street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Pearl Street is a part of old, authentic Brooklyn, and it came all the way over to the back edge of Brown Street, and as I told you before, they had a swinging bridge there. They didn't have streets to go over there then.
Right.
They had a bridge crossed over Sugar Creek, and that's how people went from Brooklyn to Cherry, unless they went all the way around the long way and come up 4th Street. And then back in 38 or 39, I'm not sure now, but I was a little boy, and I wasn't allowed to go down there and get on that swinging bridge, but it had rained, and the water was all the way over to Pearl Street, and it looked like it was a half a mile up to a three-quarters of a mile of water.
Mm-hmm.
It just looked like a great big lake, and them big boys used to get a boat, and they go around there rowing boats and stuff in that stuff. And some of them had met down on the old swinging bridge. It looked like a jungle bridge in one of those Tarzan movies, made out of rope vines and stuff. And it was a pretty steady bridge for a while because I walked it. I used to walk it with my mother going over to Cherry. And there's too many guys was on that thing. It had rained, and the guys from Cherry and the guys from Brooklyn got on that bridge, and they was all, you know, there was just too much weight on it. The bridge broke and collapsed, and about 8 or 9 guys got drowned. And I think they listed as 8, but later on they found somebody else. So it's a total of 9 guys got drowned in that thing.
How did that affect the Brooklyn community?
Any time you have a tragedy like that, it's going to affect everybody. Mm-hmm. It affected black people mostly because that's all was on the bridge with black people.
Mm-hmm.
And because the city hadn't built a connection or any kind of facility to cross over that creek to get from Brooklyn to Cherry, or from Cherry to Brooklyn, whichever, they had to walk halfway around town to come back up on the other side, it affected us. It affected us real, real bad. There were people there are people, I imagine, that still grieve about things like that because it didn't have to be, you know. And there's nobody to blame. You know, when things happen, they just happen. Because you could easily say, well, you shouldn't have been on the bridge. Or you should have known that it couldn't bear that much weight. There's all kind of ways to look at this. So you don't blame anybody, but you don't forget about things that happen. It's something that's been with me all my life.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. You have friends and things. That was guys, just a little bit older than I was, maybe. Some of them, one of them boys I know was only 9 years old.
Wow.
Hate to relive stuff like that after all these years, you know, wake up all that stuff, but it's, you know, it doesn't give you the best feeling to conjure up all those old memories and stuff. Classmates and, you know, let's talk about something else. What else you want to talk about?
Well, what was your fondest memory of the Brooklyn community? What do you remember most about it?
To be truthful, it was a house of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been nothing in that house of prayer but joy to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a meeting place. It was a mecca. Everybody wanted to go to the house of prayer. I don't care what church you belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care what kind of reports, what kind of press the House of Prayer has gotten down through the years. This was a place where one man came to town and he made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Charles Manuel Grace. We call him, some of us call him Bishop Grace, some call him Daddy Grace. Mm-hmm. I think he preferred to be called Daddy Grace, but he was a black man that kind of established his church in the midst of the people that everybody else cast aside and kind of looked down on. He was a man that took the lowest of the black and made them into somebody. He gave them voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he made them show themselves to be the best. He used to have a parade every September. They call it convocation,
mm-hmm.
and they would dress up in all of their best,
mm-hmm.
And everything would be uniformed. It was like a regalia or something that they just got out there and said to the world, "Look at us, we're somebody,"
mm-hmm.
you know. They stopped traffic in the city of Charlotte. The buses had to take a different route because Daddy Grace wanted to show his people.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave black people really something to latch on to. And from there, things started growing up, you know, going up, up, up. But I mention that because that is my fondest memory. I think about people that, you know, wasn't nothing supposedly, you know, even by their own race of people, mm-hmm. you know, they are different classes of people within a class of people.
Okay.
And people looked at the House of Prayer as a low breed of people, you know,
okay.
low education, low this, low that. But they have outdistanced everybody, black and white. There ain't a church, maybe the Catholic Church, because it's worldwide. But I don't see what no church, black or white, in the city of Charlotte has surpassed the House of Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
If you think I'm lying, do some research. Just look around at all of your churches. You might have one big white church, but the House of Prayer has one big one and about 10 little ones
right. Around
Charlotte.
Right.
You know, and they don't big. They took people off the street, people that wasn't nothing but bums and stuff. They gave them a name,
mm-hmm.
you know. They made them feel like they were somebody. They could look anybody in the face and say, "Look at me, I'm somebody,"
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they get educated now through scholarship funds and stuff like that. They don't ask people for nothing. They don't beg nobody for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just amazing what one man can do, and he never got any credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, he was greater than, and I hate to say this because it may be taken the wrong way, but he was greater than Martin Luther King, because he rallied black people where there was, you know, nothing but despair and you know, scorn, being looked down on, being pushed to the rear everywhere.
Right.
That don't exist in the house of prayer.
Right.
No. And they don't get credit from nobody. When they get ready to build something, they build it and write you a check. Uh-huh. It's over with.
Uh-huh.
Ain't no banks making no money off of the house of prayer. Now, if you think this is not true, and you, you know, check the record book, check the banks, and see who holds a note on any house of prayer property.
Right.
They ain't gonna have nothing like that. So, I think that'll be my fondest memory of Brooklyn, that house of prayer. And that's where you used to go to. My wife, she might be listening, but she say that's where we used to go to meet girls. Well, that was true. Yeah, you stand around over there and show your little new pants and slacks and whatever, your new shirt. Stand around there, somebody gonna look at you.
So even if you were a member of another congregation, everybody pretty much went to the house of prayer to be seen.
That was the place to go.
Mm-hmm.
That was the place to go, because that's where everybody congregated. You could feel comfortable there, and you could feel like you were closer to what God intended for religion to be, you know, being with the masses, with the lowest of the low, and made to feel great, you know. And there was some pretty girls over there, huh? I'll tell you that.
We've heard a lot about programs that the House of Prayer used to put on to educate children, to educate adults.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever participate in any of those, or know people who had?
No, unfortunately, I didn't join the House of Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I was a member of Grace Amy Zion.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw things in the House of Prayer that other churches used to scorn, and now they all have copied the House of Prayer ways, and they're doing the same thing, because they see the success that the House of Prayer has generated throughout its own kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And now these other churches are trying to do the same thing. But I just appreciate what Bishop Grace did.
Uh-huh.
For all the people of Brooklyn. Uh-huh. But that's where they started.
Okay. And you said you were a member of Grace AME Zion.
Mm-hmm.
What was different between the two churches?
Oh, Grace AME Zion was a Methodist church.
Uh-huh.
And it followed the Methodist system, which was based on the teachings of Richard Allen. The House of Prayer was based on a passage in the Bible, several passages in the Bible. The House of Prayer claimed to be, and I'm not sure they are not what they claim to be, but it claimed to be the house that God made. And they invite you to look at the 57th chapter of Isaiah, or 54th chapter, 7th verse. And I memorized that, even though I bring you into my holy mountain and make you joyful in my house of prayer, your burnt offerings and sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. I haven't heard of any other place being called a house of prayer for all people. This is in your Bible, Catholic Bible, Mormon's Bible, and everybody's Bible, the Holy Bible. It's there. And also, there was a segment in the New Testament where it was the only time that it showed Christ as being angry.
Mm-hmm.
When he found merchants and people selling and, you know, using the Lord's house for for their purposes, mm-hmm. for their personal gains. And he physically threw him out. He say, it is said this house is a house of prayer, and you turn it into a den of thieves. Mm-hmm. And he threw him out. Mm-hmm. And that's in there too. But this mention of a house of prayer, I've heard of all kind of church, First Baptist, Second Baptist, Third, all kinds of names, you know, university, you name it. Mm-hmm. But I don't see no names saying my house mm-hmm. is a house of prayer for all people. And the Bible states that the name will be called a house of prayer, not just mention any church as, you know, a part of that house of prayer system. I could say that this house is a house of prayer. Mm-hmm. I could say that, but it's not called that.
Right.
And it's not, you know, honoring God. You know, I don't have a sign out front to say house of prayer for all people. Now, this is just my talking. That's the, mm-hmm. you know.
So the house of prayer was welcoming to everyone.
Everyone. Mm-hmm. And we always had a white person or two to join to, mm-hmm. you know, who I think was courageous people to do that. Something like John Brown. I can see how isolated he must have felt when he decided to support the slave and help them out of their ordeal. Mm-hmm. You know, this take a brave white person to do that. Mm-hmm. There's some good ones in this world. You know, all white people ain't bad, like all black people ain't bad.
Right.
You know, that's the way white people think. But they try to keep us, you know, used to. Back in my day, they kept us down pretty good. Even in school, the books that we had to pay for, they was 2 years behind whites, black. Y'all took English, not English, took English every year, but biology. We didn't get biology until the 10th grade.
Uh-huh.
Shit, them whites, excuse the expression, them whites over there, I had a friend over there and Harding High. Back then they didn't have but two schools, Harding High and Central High. Mm-hmm. White, those were the two white schools. The two black schools were West Charlotte and Second Ward.
Right.
And we used to get their little old hand-me-down stuff after they done sweated and faded that crap out. They'd give it to us and we'd run around in them little old bleached out uniforms and stuff, mm-hmm. you know. But what got me was I used to work downtown at a shoe store. I never got to sell no shoes. I was the stock boy. I'd bring the shoes out and I'd stock one. Somebody tell me to go get me a size this and then I'd go get that. That was what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
Like a doggone runner. But I was working and I got paid something. But anyway, there was a guy that, he was in high school too. He worked, he went to Harding.
Mm-hmm.
And we was talking about our you know, our curriculum and our, you know, subject matter in certain grades. And I told him, you know, I liked my biology because, you know, biology, study of living things.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed biology. And I would tell him, he said, you taking biology? You still taking? I still my butt. I ain't still. I'm just getting there. He said, we had that in 8th grade. Shoot, and already I was in 11th grade. No, I was in the 10th grade, because that's when we was taking it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, we got to talking and weighing this thing out. I found out that by design, they was educating whites a level above us. And, you know,
wow.
I can tell you things that you knew, you probably ain't never heard and probably wouldn't believe. But it's true. They meant for us to stay behind forever. But it ain't going to be that way, because people are just going to go the way that God intended for them to go. We've found a way. I might, you know, not be able to express myself like I want to. Like I can,
mm-hmm.
I don't care if this thing is on or not, because what I tell you is is the gospel. It's what God like, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't. I thought you was coming. I really did. But I wouldn't have bit more been here by myself. You know, white woman come in here?
Mm-hmm.
No, Lord. That's why I kept my wife from her exercise.
Oh.
I want somebody to be in this house because the way I've been trained and the way I learned to fear the evil people of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, I'm white woman might come in here and she just might get mad at me and go somewhere and say, he touched me, you know, and he did. Shh. Mm-mm. You ain't gonna get that out of me,
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that. But this is what happens when you condition, you know, to hatred and bigotry,
mm-hmm.
violence and stuff like that. You have to know how to walk in this world to stay alive. Now we're faced with a different set of challenges that, you know, we got to face up to now. But it ain't the same as it used to be. And my kids, they're smart as anybody else because they came up in a system that let them put their, you know, their knowledge against anybody else. It's just a competitive world now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you can't compete, you just can't compete. But it wasn't that way when I came up. I know this ain't part of the interview, so because I done got off on one of my tirades now. So
well, let's get back to Brooklyn. You were a shoe shine. You had a shoe shine stand.
Yeah.
Do you remember any specific characters?
Yeah. My uncle, his name was N.G. Edward. His name was Napoleon Golden Edwards, but we just called him N.G.
Mm-hmm.
for. Nickname. Yeah, he was a head barber, and he got we still have a Edwards barbershop. The family still own barbershop. He expected me to do it,
mm-hmm.
to learn to cut hair, and I do. I cut my own kids' hair. I got clippers hooked up in there, but I can't be standing on my feet.
Mm.
You know, I found a different way to make a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an honest way. And I just think about growing up and doing those things. When I was shining shoes, I made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a bit of money. People be surprised how much money you can make shining shoes. There's some people they just give you money just to feel big themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they can say that that, you know, or so they can feel big. I've seen soldiers during the Second World War. You didn't have to do nothing. Just have your shoe shine box there and ask your shoe shine, mister. And my shoes look okay, but here's a dollar. You know, I get a kid up. Get a kid something, man. Give him something. You know, they make the other ones give you something. And my pockets was getting stuff full of money. I remember once I had so many quarters and started walking home. I had to hold my pocket like that, because it wasn't safe to walk down the railroad, but that's the way I had to come.
Mm-hmm.
And there were hobos back then. I mean, real hobos.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know what a hobo is or was. There used to be people that they were like vagrants. They
mm-hmm.
they drifted from town to town. They catch a freight train and go in wherever the train going. And they'd be laying beside the railroad tracks over against a fence, you know, or wherever there's a bed of grass, they can kind of smooth out something and lay down. They were just vagrants that traveled by train. But anyway, I was walking down the railroad, and this guy, I had let my pocket go. I was just walking along my shoe shine box, and a hobo was laying over on the side of the tracks, kind of leaning against the fence. And he said, "Come out, boy." And I started moving fast. I was walking, I grabbed my pocket and was moving. And he said, "Boy," I said, "come here." And I started running.
Mm-hmm.
And He was too tired or too drunk or too something to even chase me. He tried to scare me to make me stop. He told me, "Boy, if you don't stop," I'd look back at him. He was way back there. I was not running, looking. He said, "Boy, if you don't stop, I'll put a lightning bug up your butt." And I was gone. But he really did catch me. And I wasn't too far. I ran to where I knew some people. It was a long way from my house, but I knew a kid that went to school with me. So we were, very close. We played together at school. And I ran to their house because that was the closest place to me, because I didn't know if that guy would follow me or what. Because mm-hmm. I did have some money on me, and some good money, too. I used to have a lot of money, but I earned it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, getting back to Brooklyn. See, I'm not a good interviewer. I'm going to tell you that now, because I reminisce too much and I relive the past,
uh-huh.
You know. And it's hard to pass a place and not stop and say and revisit it,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Any other characters that you remember?
Oh, I remember all them guys. I remember every doctor
mm-hmm.
in that building, every business owner within that building. As I tell you before, there was a Yancey's drugstore underneath the building.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle's barbershop. There was a beauty shop next door, Excelsior Beauty Shop. Then there was Susie's Grill. Everybody knows Susie's Grill.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Bill Brown. He had a newsstand and everything. That is just a hustler. Knew how to make a dollar. But 2nd Street, I've told you about 2nd Street. 1st Street, there wasn't too much on 1st Street.
No.
But the Lincoln Theater, now I'm going to tell you, when I was coming up, all these guys that grew up to be big time entertainers, like Red Fox and Pig Meat Markham, Slappy White, all them guys used to be in Charlotte every Saturday night. There'd be one of them would be there at the Lincoln Theater after they have their regular movie.
Mm-hmm.
They would have what we call a minstrel.
Okay.
And the minstrel started at 11 o'clock after the movie was let out. And all kinds of stuff. They had dance girls and all that stuff up on the stage. And I didn't get to see all that. Because I was too young mm-hmm. to go in and see. This was for grown-ups. Now, around the place that we call the Green Willow Garden,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't go in there, but it had a big wooden fence around there, and all they had knot holes in there where you could peep and see everything that goes on. Hey, I had a colorful life. I saw everything I wanted to see, and some things I wasn't supposed to see. But I saw it all. And I saw Pig Meat and Red Fox and all them guys, but I didn't get inside the movie to see them. I see them going in.
Mm-hmm.
I stand out on the street because everybody was doing stuff, barbecuing, selling. Everybody selling liquor and stuff on the side because Charlotte was a dry town.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we got liquor in the city of Charlotte until about 1948.
Wow.
Yeah, and maybe later than that because we used to didn't have no liquor. You had to go down South Carolina. They were selling all kind of liquor down in South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
The bootleggers didn't want Charlotte to open up no liquor store or North Carolina. They didn't want that to happen because it messed their business up.
Mm-hmm. So the bootleggers didn't come up to Charlotte at all? You had to go down?
Oh, you used to have to go to South Carolina
right.
to buy. They had liquor called seal liquor
mm-hmm.
and liquor there called white liquor, you
mm-hmm.
know. Now that white ain't never been legal, but that's what everybody wanting, and that's what old Junior Johnson. And we had a guy in Charlotte named what was Buck's name? He used to go to the house, work for him. He had a son named Buck too. A race car driver. They the one that started NASCAR. Mm. Yeah. I could go ask my wife, but anyway. When you find a guy named Buck something, that's the one.
Okay.
He was only Buck in Charlotte. I can't call that guy name. This is what happened when you get up in your 70s. Memory start lapsing. I think about it. And maybe another hour or so, and maybe sooner. And that's the way it is now. And I can name every building down through there and every business on 2nd Street. I see the Lincoln Theater on one side, then the YMCA, mm-hmm. Green Willow Garden, Ames Ingram, but this place was named El Chico then. Then on the other side was Isla Drugstore. Oh, started from the corner, the AME Zion Publishing House. Mm-hmm. And that building is still here. Not the same building, mm-hmm. but it's down on the corner of 2nd Street now.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, the publishing house, AME Zion Publishing House is right down there.
Okay.
But it's a new building.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, the publishing house, and then they had a little open field. That's where all them barbecue mm-hmm. Pits and stuff be out there. People be hustling sandwiches, barbecue sandwiches, and shot of liquor on the table, and whatever you wanted, you could get it on 2nd Street. Isla's Drugstore, McKissick Shoe Shop, Fred Patton's little old place. No matter how to patronize Fred. The Elks. Mud Cup. Mud was there, and a friend of mine I saw the other day, poor thing, she's a lady barber. She had a little barber shop there, cut hair. She's a young lady too.
Mm-hmm.
Martha McClinton. She's one of the oldest barbershops. She used to work for my uncle,
mm-hmm.
and she left my uncle. And put her own barbershop up on 2nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And she did well. She owned a lot of property now. Owned a lot of property. She still looks young enough for somebody to try to pick up.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard a lot about the vibrancy and community of Brooklyn, how it was so close-knit. What, in your opinion, was the reason for the closeness, for the vibrancy?
Well, that's an easy one. We only had each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we had. You know, when you're in an environment where, and this is the one I think fits Brooklyn the best, where you're like an underdog or an also-ran, you know, you're the one across the track,
mm-hmm.
The community across the track. Everybody feel that they're a little better. They go to the churches where the businessmen go and the teachers go. It used to be teachers were like guards or something. People looked up to a teacher because they had to have a little smarts to get through college. You just couldn't be a teacher without being educated,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of put those people up on pedestals, and I could get back at some of my teachers now. I could talk about them, but I ain't gonna talk about them because they were wrong
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people just think that they're too above you to even teach, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to leave them alone. God will take care of them. He already has. I've surpassed most of them that I see. Some of them, I've seen them in such bad shape, I had to take them somewhere, wait on them, and kind of help them out. Like they are my people. I would do my own people that way. You know, when you done rose so high and fell so low, you know, you got to ask the students and stuff to help you to do this or that. Because one of the best things I think that happened to me in life is to have the kind of parents that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 8 kids, and my father never let us know we were poor.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I was poor till I grew up and looked at other people and looked where they came from. And, you know, after I reached a certain plateau, you know, I could look back and see where I came from. But he never let us know that. He insulated us with a kind of love. He worked so hard. That's why he died young. I consider him dying young because he wasn't 66 mm-hmm. when he died, and he was broke down. But he used to work at a regular job, and then he would do people lawns and rake leaves, and he'd pick up money in any kind of way he could, you know, to give us the things that we needed. So we had everything.
Mm-hmm.
We never got to understand that we were poor until we were able to look around and see the circumstances that other people were in, but they didn't have a father like I was.
Mm-hmm.
My mother never worked.
Mm-hmm.
She never worked. He always provided well. Yeah, she couldn't work with 8 children. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to do any work.
That was a lot of work.
but he kept her off the job.
Mm-hmm.
Her job was in the house, and he made sure. There was some time I didn't get to see my dad until the weekend because
mm-hmm.
he had 2 jobs. He would work his regular job in the daytime, and he'd go to a job that cleaned up buildings and stuff, and he'd work till about 1
mm-hmm.
o'clock in the morning, you know, cleaning up buildings. And,
right.
and he never had a car.
Mm-hmm.
He had a bicycle. He used to ride a bicycle, but there wasn't many cars. You could stand out, back down here on Beta Ford Road,
mm-hmm.
you could stand out on your front porch and watch the road. And maybe every 2 hours or so, you might see a car go by.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't no cars around here then.
Right.
Back in the 30s, there were no cars. And in a black section of town, there wasn't many people that could afford a car.
Right.
There was one man, 2 men that I knew that had cars, and one of them, my daddy, threatened him because he used to drink, and he drove too fast, and he'd come around that corner, and sometimes he couldn't straighten up. He took out about 3 rows of my daddy's corn one day.
Mm.
my dad used to have his shotgun hanging up over the door on a rack. He got his stuff and went down there. And Mr. Anthony paid him for his corn. And he told him, my dad told him, don't come through there because his children could be playing in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hurt one of them children, you're going to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And he meant that. He sure did. And Long kind of straightened up then, but he didn't stop drinking, but he stopped speeding
mm-hmm.
through that. I mean, he'd get that cigar in his doggone mouth and had that old pint of white liquor on the seat beside him. He'd take him a swig. I used to see him leaving home. He'd take a swig before he even cranked up good. It's crazy. He had too much, you know, too much freedom. He mm-hmm. needed some extra work to do. He was a moneymaker. He made money as a plasterer. They don't have those now. They got guys that do drywall.
Right.
They don't even do no plastering now.
Right.
You know about that?
Plastering? I didn't. Yeah, I've actually tried it before in a couple
drywalling.
Classes. No, plaster.
Plaster.
It's
that
not
plaster.
Easy.
You got to hold that stuff on that platform,
mm-hmm.
and mix it up, and that old spatula.
Yeah, got to have good wrist action.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Lum was a plaster contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what my daddy called him. His name was Columbus Anthony. Well, he straightened Lum out. My wife knew about Lum. Lum used to be a mess. Good God Almighty. What else you want to ask me?
Well, I know part of this process is also learning about urban renewal and the destruction and displacement of Brooklyn residents.
Brooklyn. They didn't hurt Charlotte when they tore Brooklyn down.
Really?
They didn't hurt Charlotte at all. There wasn't nothing but slums down there in mm-hmm. Brooklyn. Yeah.
Do you know where the people went? Do you know where the people relocated to?
No. They wouldn't relocate. They didn't do that kind of stuff then.
Mm-hmm.
You own your own.
Right.
They didn't raise Brooklyn until about, the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, everything had changed. People had changed. The whole culture in the city of Charlotte had changed. People were going in the army. They had a war going on in Korea. That's how I got drafted.
Mm.
People were coming back, going to school. Soldiers was going to school on the GI Bill. It just sprouted up a new group of people. Didn't nobody want to go back to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot. Brooklyn wasn't nothing but a bunch of old shanties and splinter, could have called it Splinter Village,
mm-hmm.
down in Alamo, wooden houses on stilt,
mm-hmm.
and stuff hanging all over into the creek. People loved it,
mm-hmm.
but when they got away from it and got to look back at it, you could say, thank you, Jesus. Look where you brought me from. Because that's, now people done made Brooklyn bigger than what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Brooklyn, the way it looks now, it was all of Second Ward, but that's not the truth.
Right.
It was not. It was not all of Second Ward. It was a part of Second Ward. It was a lower part of Second Ward, and it wasn't nothing to brag on.
Mm.
Nothing to brag on. Nothing. But people that lived there loved it.
Right.
When they tore it down, they tried to make it disappear forever. They didn't retain any of their names. When they raised an area around here in Charlotte, I've seen where mostly they retained some of the names and things. Like I noticed over in Greenville when they tore it down and rebuilt it, they kept a lot of the names. Not all, but Burton Street is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Washington Avenue is still there. Spring Street is still there. Fontana is still there. All of those streets. Mm-hmm. Hamilton Street is still there.
Mm-hmm.
But when they tore Brooklyn down, ain't no more Pearl Street, no more Crocker Street,
mm-hmm.
no more Long Street, no more Pearl Street, no more Brown Street, no more Boundary Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's all gone.
Right.
They made Brooklyn disappear.
Right.
Period. And I think they had plans down the road, to send the city that way. Because I think now they want to tap Cherry down, and I don't know where they're going to go.
Mm.
Cherry was a place that the white folks established anyway. A lot of people don't want to accept that. They think Cherry, was a community that was developed by black people, but it wasn't. It was a place set up for those white folks, maids and the yard men and all that stuff, and it's right on the edge of Myers Park and Dilworth,
mm-hmm.
so they didn't have far to walk to work. That's
right.
how so the man could come and get you, the lady of the house who could drive a car, they'd go get their maids and stuff,
Mm.
Oh, they didn't want to have to drive far. That's where Cherry came from.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, those Cherry people, they all pretty much belonged to jobs nearby.
Okay. Well, is there anything that maybe I haven't asked that you wanted to talk about?
I think I didn't talk too much. But everything I've told you, I've only told you bits of it. I could talk about things. Yeah, I could tell you in detail, but I'm not, because it wouldn't mean anything to anyone. I don't think it would. There are too many people that know about Brooklyn that don't want to talk about it. Mm. I told you all, you know, that I can tell you without this laboring you with, you know, personal feelings about this and that. Brooklyn was not a Mecca, I tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Not a Mecca.
Okay.
It wasn't bad. And I tell you what saved Brooklyn, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know what other people think, but was the House of Prayer.
Uh-huh.
It gave those people a place to go to. It gave them a sense of belonging to something. Those people wouldn't dare to go to the church that I was going to up there on Brevard Street.
Uh-huh.
Some of those people, they wouldn't let them in the church.
Wow.
I mean, you know, there's some people. I've seen people that didn't have shoes, they didn't have underwear, they'd wear pants until they had patches, not patches, but holes in the butt. Some of them was able to get something to patch them.
Uh-huh.
But you could look through the holes in the clothes and see people raw behind, you know. It hadn't been a easy ride.
Right.
But
the House of Prayer
came a long
gave
way.
Him hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
House of Prayer gave him hope. And I did it without, you know, being a member of the House of Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because of good old Uncle Sugar. I ain't got much, but what I got is mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I got 3 bedrooms upstairs. And I got about everything I need. I got a Lincoln and I got a Cadillac out there in my yard. I got $100,000 in the bank, money in my pocket. And I owe that to Uncle Sugar for drafting me in the Army. I learned a lot. Made a lot of money, stayed on in that 30 years. Hell, I'd probably be in that now if I could do anything. I retired from there, come out here and went to work for the post office. Retired from the post office.
Mm-hmm.
Got my Social Security. I don't even call Uncle Sam Uncle no more. I call him Daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. That's what saved me, was my ability to live through all them wars.
Mm-hmm.
And got hurt too.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. I'm full of Agent Orange. I didn't have. I had that damn cancer twice on me, man. 2 different places popped out on me. Get rid of one place, come out another place. It's going to come out again because my body's full of Agent Orange. I was in Vietnam in 66 and we was spraying that stuff. Didn't know what it was. Didn't have a name for it. We call it defoliant.
Right.
And you could see it in the plane come over.
Wow.
And drop that stuff. It looked like smoke, and then you could see them leaves on the trees start crinkling and drawing up, and they just turned brown on you.
Wow.
You see, because there used to be a lot of snipers hiding up in them trees, they'd be popping you off, and you don't see where it's coming from. So they brought that stuff in, but we didn't realize that it was hurting us too,
right,
down the road, you know. But I'm satisfied. I've lived. 76 years is a pretty good number, you know, and I'm still here.
Oh, we're very glad you are. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
For your interview and your time.
Okay, and you edit any bad stuff out of that, though. I don't want people to hear